I would come into churches and I'd give a lot of evidence for creation and a lot of evidence for Genesis being correct. And I think people, Christians in strong churches, they inherently know that there's some issue with this millions and billions of years. You don't find it anywhere in God's word, and you find the opposite everywhere. But they would still accept the idea that the Egyptian culture goes back 9,000 years and the Native Americans came into North America over the Bering Straits like 15,000 years ago, because you hear it over and over and over again. Or they'd find somebody encased in ice that had like died during the ice age and he lived like 20 or 30,000 years ago. And it's all based on radiocarbon dating and other assumptions of anthropologists. And I had never taken the time to just kind of figure out how do all of the cultures of the world, the Egyptians and the Peruvians and the native North Americans and the Chinese, how could they all fit into a time frame that started after the flood? Because that's what the Bible tells us. Every human being on this planet came from Noah and his three sons. And that happened about 4,500 years ago. So that's what this book of the same title, Brilliant, Made in the Image of God, is about. I spent 2 years on it. And as I started to study these ancient cultures, I was really stunned at the kind of stuff I was finding, because they were absolutely brilliant. They weren't just ignorant, Stone Age, drag your wife by her hair into the cave with your club and cook a meal for me mentalities and cultures. So we're going to walk through the eras of history. What was happening before the flood of Noah? What was happening for the next few hundred years after Noah? What was happening from 4,000 years ago to 3,000 years ago and 3,000 years ago until the time of Christ 2,000 years ago across the world in earth history? And Christians love this book because they don't typically get to see it all put into a biblical time frame and how it all fits together. I'm going to cover only about 10% of what's in the book in the next hour. And this really is about an hour and a half lecture where I've taken a lot of stuff out just to get it to fit in an hour. And in this video series I've done, there are 18 lessons. Two of them deal with the brilliance of ancient mankind. So I broke this into two different sessions because there's so much neat information. Now, this is a biblical view of history, and I suspect you've probably seen this. It's a very strong answer in Genesis Foundation teaching, that there have been major interactions of God in history. And if you leave them out, you will guaranteed to misinterpret history. A literal, supernatural, out-of-nothing creation of the universe and then of life. That death and disease and bloodshed and sorrow and agonies of life are here because we brought it upon ourselves. And if they weren't there, we would be forever separated from God. And that God is a just God, has to penalize sin, or he's not just. He's not holy. God can't be holy and just ignore sin. The two are opposites. His very nature demands that there's payment for sin. The worldwide flood is a real event that really happened. And it totally changes your viewpoint of archaeology and paleontology and earth history. If you leave it out, you're going to get it all wrong. Now, here's what we're talking about today. Where did all the people come from, and how come there's so many, and how did all the cultures of the world arise in such a short period of time? And it's an important topic. Now, here's why. There really are only two options to explain our existence. Either one day here on Earth, a paradise planet that had been made by God, there were no people. And the very next day, there are two fully formed, fully functional, incredibly intelligent human beings that have been created by God. And they look like they're not babies. They look like they've been around a long time because they're fully grown. So they instantaneously have the appearance of age, okay? That's one viewpoint. The viewpoint the world around us has adopted is that that is fantasy and fairy tales and storytelling and religion, and it isn't true. Well, if that's not true, then where did we come from? The only other possibility is that something that wasn't a human turned into a human. And since you've left out the truth, you have to believe the alternative. You get it? It's not stupidity. It's not the fact that scientists aren't intelligent. Once you've left the truth out, you're stuck with believing the only other alternative. Now, if that's true, well, I'll get back to this in a second. There's certain implications that come with it as you interpret everything you find in the past, things that have been buried. Now, there was a movie made quite a while ago that, like, cinematographers and Hollywood critics, they get together and they judge what was the greatest factual documentary ever made, what was the greatest comedy ever made. Well, they came together probably after the year 2000, and they talked amongst themselves and decided what was the most impactful, the greatest science fiction film ever made. Any guesses? Just shout it out really loud so I can hear. And what do you think is the most important science fiction film ever made that influenced our culture? Planet of the Apes. There were like six of them with Charlton Heston in the 1970s. That always comes up because they were so popular and so prevalent. But no, that's not the one the critics chose. They didn't like Rodney McDowell dressed up in a monkey suit. Any other guesses? What's your favorite science fiction film? Star Trek? Man, that impacted me in my generation. I love science. I love those films. But that wasn't the one they picked. Any other guesses? Star Wars. Yeah, man. Made Spielberg a billionaire. But nope, that wasn't it either. And I'm going to tell you. And you wouldn't necessarily guess this, but I'll explain it as we go along. 2001, A Space Odyssey. Okay? Stanley Kubrick's classic book. Now, this movie, if you haven't seen it, it starts for the first 10 minutes, there is nobody talking. It just shows a bunch of apes screaming and screeching at each other and sleeping in caves and throwing sticks and jumping up and down and shouting. And then there's the key moment in the movie where one of the apes discovers something. We're going to show that little clip. So it'll narrate for a little bit. Here's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa, okay? And great-grandpa has discovered a pile of bones. And he's kind of scooting around after screeching at his friends and throwing sticks at each other. And he picks up a bone and kind of drops it back and forth. Whoop! And it made another bone flip up. And his little monkey brain starts thinking about that. And by the way, a little bit earlier, there was this big alien structure that gave him a thought. What could I do with this bone? Some alien put a thought in his head. And as he lifts the bone up higher and swings it harder, the bones fly even higher. And he starts thinking in his little monkey brain, wow, this is kind of like a tool. I could use it to make things happen. I can hit something in the head and it'll break their skull. I can hunt with a tool and get more food and feed my family. And mankind has discovered how to use a tool. He's gotten a little bit smarter. And in the movie, he throws that bone up in the air. In the movie, fast forward like 100,000 years, and then they show a spaceship flying off toward Jupiter. And then there's an adventure. But so why is that the most impactful film in science fiction? Because it cemented the concept of where we came from. It's one of the basic worldview questions. Where did you come from? And movies are the pulpit of today because they've got stories. They have video. They have music. They have images. They have emotion. And it's all wrapped up in front of you. In every movie you watch, you are learning the worldview of the person promoting the movie. And you're internalizing it. Whether you realize it or not, that's what your brain is doing. And this is agreeing with everything they're showing in the textbooks and the National Geographic magazines and the museums and later on the internet. It's all just driving it home as reality. Now, if that is true, it ignores the other possibility that we were created. It means the further back you go in time, the less building ability people should have had. The more grunts and groans and simplistic their language structure should have been. Their social structures should have been very, very simple. Their inventiveness should have been less developed. The further we go back into civilizations. So by looking at what do we find, we should be able to distinguish which one of these viewpoints really makes the most sense. And that's what this lecture is all about. Did we come from ape-like creatures, or were we created based on looking at archaeology? Now, the focus is on mankind's knowledge of early biblical events that he couldn't have had unless these events were real, and his obvious knowledge and inventiveness from the very start of civilizations. It's like, you can't just have a highly advanced civilization. There ought to be all sorts of lead up to it. And by the way, that's the way archaeologists are going to interpret anything they find. Whatever they find, they're going to place it into a template of, well, there was a stone age where you had a bunch of apish creatures. Then eventually we got smarter, and there was like a bronze age where we started to figure out how to build structures and buildings. And then we got better, and we had an iron age where we could have machines and cogs and tools. And then finally we had the modern age. And whatever they find, well, that's reality. They're going to stick their finds into that template of those ages. And they're going to find ways to make it all fit. And that's what goes on throughout historical world history textbooks. Now, what was going on from 6,000 years ago until 4,000, I think it's more like 4,360 years ago, before the worldwide flood? A complete change of this entire planet. Well, essentially nothing survived this flood. When you really start to understand the flood, and my books are filled with examples and other lectures, I spend the whole lecture talking about it, this flood pulverized and totally restructured this planet. Nothing survived. The pyramids were not built before the flood. They're made from limestone blocks. Limestone is particles of lime that fuse together to form a rock layer that happened during the flood. So the pyramids are made from rocks that were formed during the flood. They didn't exist before the flood. And they would not have survived a 1,000-foot tidal wave filled with sediment sweeping across the continent. They would just be gone. Entire continents were removed and restructured. But memories of things that happened before the flood would have survived. Noah wasn't stupid. He would have taken documents and all sorts of artifacts and all sorts of knowledge with him. He had 120 years to prepare and to build this enormous structure and to warn humanity what was coming. Noah, it was called the preacher of righteousness. He didn't just build an ark. He was out there trying to put the truth in front of people. And after the flood, there would have been rapid civilization rebuilding, but with wide variations. Someone who had access to the knowledge, imagine how much you could learn if you lived 900 years. 900 years of trying and learning and developing incredibly intelligent human beings. They had all sorts of technology and understanding of things before the flood. Noah would have brought some of this information with him, and civilizations that had access to that would have been rapidly advancing. And civilizations that didn't and were eking out existence during an ice age, they would have been just trying to survive with sticks and stones and rocks and cave shelters, both living at the same time, same area of Earth history. And that's what we're going to see as we go through this. Couple examples. In China, they found a cast bronze sculpture of a tree. And this was found in the 1970s in one of the provinces of China. It's in the book. They actually have a museum built around this find. It's 12 foot tall, and the leaves are shaped like knives, which is kind of symbolic of something that's forbidden or dangerous, okay? Now, archaeologists put this at about 3,800 years, and I think that's probably pretty accurate. It may go back a little further, but it's after the flood, okay? People spread out. A group went to China after the Tower of Babel. Some went to Africa. Some went to Europe. Some went to other places. Ended up in the Polynesian Islands, all the way into North America eventually. Different languages, different people groups. Acknowledged as the earliest civilizations on Earth are the Chinese culture, the Egyptian culture, and the Indo-European culture in the India area. Those are like the three cradles of the earliest civilizations on Earth that were highly advanced and rapidly developed. So here's what those knives look like. They're just sharp knife-looking things, and you'll notice there's a fruit nestled in the middle of the knives. So here's a 12-foot-tall bronze sculpture of a tree with dangerous leaves and a fruit hidden amongst the knives. There's a snake at the base of the leaves, at the base of the tree. This is what he looks like. The snake still has legs. What do you know about that? He looks kind of a dangerous, kind of mean-looking guy, like someone who you don't want to be listening to. So here is the Chinese culture, one of the earliest cultures after the flood, building a 12-foot sculpture showing a forbidden tree with a forbidden fruit and a snake at the base of the tree. And to cap it all off, there's a human hand reaching toward the fruit. Now, where did those concepts come from? Chinese culture supposedly goes back 10, 12,000 years. Why would they have these same concepts? Because after the flood, they wanted the next generation to know, if they knew nothing else, why does sin and death and disease exist on this planet? Because in a real event, in real history, the first human beings disobeyed God, said, I don't want you to be God. I don't want you to make the rules. I want to be God. I want to make the rules. And there had to be punishment for that when they reached into a forbidden tree for a forbidden fruit when tempted by Satan in the form of a snake. All the concepts are right there because it's real history. I mean, that's astounding. And there it is. That ought to be in every history book, but it's not. And then there's language development. The Chinese, one of the oldest cultures, their original language that goes back 4,000 years or more, had symbols that looked like this. And every symbol corresponded to a word. Instead of letters, they'd have symbols corresponding to words. Now, the first symbol is a symbol for anger. The second one, look, that's a symbol, you probably can't read it, it's for diarrhea, which means you need number three, which is toilet, and so on. But the thing is, there were 80,000 symbols. That's not a simple language. You'd have to memorize what 80,000 symbols meant in order to communicate well. I imagine singing the alphabet song to your children at night to put them to sleep. They don't have 26 letters, they have 80,000 symbols. But even more astounding, hundreds of these symbols are tied to biblical events that happened before the flood or after the flood. Well, before the flood, many of them. For instance, garden. What is their symbol for garden? Well, this little upside down T kind of thing is a symbol that means dust. A little square right below it means breath. The little K-like symbol means two people. And the big rectangular means an enclosure. So if you take dust and give it breath and turn it into two people inside of an enclosure, that's their symbol for garden. Isn't that astounding? Chinese knew exactly what happened way back in the Garden of Eden. This is way before Moses wrote it down in the book of Genesis. That was 3,200 years ago. They had the same information 800 or more years earlier. And then you've already looked ahead, I'm sure, boat. A vessel with eight people is a boat. Why not a vessel with 12 people? A vessel with two people? A vessel with seven people? How many people were on Noah's ark? Noah, his wife, three sons, three daughter-in-laws. Eight people, because it was a real event. See, we've got to, brothers and sisters, Christians, stop treating the Bible as storytelling. It is factual, actual, historical reality. And it shows up, not just in the Bible, but in other cultures. The world around us is clueless. They never hear this. They never stop and watch a lecture like this. We've got to share it, or they're not going to know it. And it's that, as Pastor Joey said, it's that pre-evangelism foundation you can start to lay down. Talking about communication, I just threw this one in. It comes a little later in history. But just the inventiveness of mankind. You think of the Incas as these really ancient people and Aztecs and so on. When the Spanish came over and conquered them, and their culture goes back a couple thousand or more years. Actually, it goes back about 3,000 or more years. They did not have any written alphabet or any printed language. So, I mean, how do you do economics? How do you do trade and commerce? How do you do this stuff when you don't have anything you can write down to keep track of stuff? Well, instead, they had these things called the quipuses. What they would do, they would take a long strand of cord, and they would tie knots in it at different locations, and different numbers of knots and different length cords. And then they would tie that cord to another one, and they'd have a whole bunch of cords hanging down of different lengths and different number of knots at different locations. They'd roll it up and they put it in a bamboo pole. So you'd have a runner holding a pole. They had a highway that went, in essence, all the way from New York City to Los Angeles, up and down over the top of the Andes Mountains, called the Inca Highway. They would hand it, and they'd have stations all the way along. They'd hand the thing, the runner would run for like 8 hours, hand it to the next guy. He'd run for 8 hours, hand it to the next guy. They could run a message all the way from New York to Los Angeles in a matter of a week or more. The guy at the other end would unroll it, and he would read that like we would read a newspaper. See, each knot, each length, each segment, the number of knots, it's like degrees of freedom. Like we have 26 letters, they'd have, depending on how they did it, 30 or more degrees of freedom. Number of knots, number of the location and length and so on. And they could communicate across their kingdom. The Spanish never bothered to ask them how to translate it, so it's all lost. Knowledge was completely lost. So that's the kind of thing we know of the factual things that were happening, not just in the Bible, but in cultures all over the world, because of their things that show up in these archaeological finds. Now, what was happening after the flood? Mankind is struggling to reestablish a foothold on a totally devastated planet. Everything has changed. The majority of animals, there's more animals that went extinct than are alive today. Every bit of vegetation was swept out. The earth was a mud flat. When you understand God's word, Noah, from the moment that flood started and God sent the animals, because God would have known the ones, it's like if I was bringing the dog kind, I'd probably bring like maybe a couple of Irish setters or Cocker Spaniels or some of my favorite breed. But all the information for every breed of dog is locked into the DNA code of a gray wolf. So some wolf-like creature Noah wouldn't have known had to be sent that would have had all the variety and the information needed to make all the breeds of dogs to survive in all the environments of the world later. God sent the animals. And Noah's ark landed after 7 months. But he stayed on that ark for 5 more months. I mean, I'd have been letting those stinking, pooping animals out like right away. I'm done, man. I'm sick of this. But the world was a mud flat. And it wasn't until vegetation started to take root and started to grow. And think how long it takes in the summer when you plant a garden until it's full of weeds. It doesn't take 12 years. In a matter of a month or two, you got nothing but weeds filling your garden. So in 5 months, there's a lot of vegetation out there. And then he could let the animals out, and things have dried out. The whole account of Noah doesn't make sense unless you realize it's a real event. Well, mankind's going to be struggling to reestablish a foothold. Hundreds of years would have passed before Babel. There's a guaranteed ice age, and I'll get back to that in about 5 minutes. Now, I got a question for you. Abraham shows up in Egypt, biblically. You can just follow all the timelines back. There's all sorts of dates, and it's very clear when you study Scripture, about 3,900 years ago. The flood was about 4,400 years ago. That only leaves 500 years for the ark to have landed, people to have grouped together, built the Tower of Babel, spread out, formed different cultures and different civilizations, and an advanced, very highly populous civilization called Egypt having formed. Only 400 years. And I thought to myself, how does that even happen? I mean, that's the kind of thing skeptics throw out there to say the Bible can't possibly be true. So I sat down with pencil and paper and decided to figure it out. And you've got to make some assumptions. Just try to get some reasonable assumptions. First of all, you have to realize that people are going to be highly motivated to have children. I mean, let's assume Noah never had any other children. So you just have three couples. They're going to be motivated to have a lot of children. And they're living for hundreds of years. These people were still living right after the flood for 300 and 400 years. Their lifetimes haven't dropped off as much yet. So over hundreds of years, you could literally have 100 or more children. But let's just say every family only had 20 children over a 50-year period. Remember, they're living longer. Right now, a woman in her mid-teens up until her mid-50s, maybe a 40-year period, might have children. Let's just say over 50 years, they had 20 children. Now, that sounds, even today, that sounds like, I had 20 children. I want to ask, in known documented historical times, what do you think is the record for a single woman just in the last 250 years or so, for a single woman with the most children? How many children did one woman have over her lifetime? Give me a guess. And I'll tell you right now, it's more than 20. Any guesses? Come on, interact. 28, 30, 32, more. 60, more. More than 60. You're getting close, though, so I'll just tell you. And I got a bunch of information on this next slide. 69 children. 1765, every time she was pregnant, she had twins or triplets. She started in her teens, ended in her 50s. 69 children from one woman. If you go on Wikipedia, and this has been a few years ago, they documented 50 women, just in our generation or the one past us, who have had 20 or more children. When I grew up, there were tons of people in our neighborhood that had 10 and 12 children. So this idea that four is a big family is a really, really, really relatively recent human idea. People had lots of children historically. There were less magnetic mistakes. The magnetic field of the earth was much stronger even after the flood, which means there was less deterioration from the sun's radiation and mutations and so on. Less variations of dangerous diseases, I suspect. So people had a lot of children. Now let's take that assumption and look at Egypt. Let's suppose one group came out of Babel. After the flood, 50 years passed. Each of the three couples had 20 children. That's 60, plus the original eight would mean 50 years after the ark landed, there could be 68 people on this planet. And I think there were way more, but let's just say that. Because you already have another generation in that 50 years going on. But this is really conservative. So 100 years later, those 68 people would have paired up. Now you have 30 new couples, each of them having 20 children. 100 years later, you'd have 600 people on the planet. Those pair up into 300 couples. They each have 20 children. 3,000 couples. Let's put the Tower of Babel 200 years after the flood. You would have had 66,608 people on the planet. Probably way more, okay? And then they break up into language groups. In Genesis, it lists a table of nations, and it lists, I believe, 40 different nations. So you divide that, or 70 different nations. You assume there were 70 different language groups. That's just an assumption. But you divide that 66,000 by 70, you get 3,000 couples, or about 428 couples per language group that spread out. So let's say 200 years after the flood, there's only 400 people in Egypt. Now those start multiplying. 4,100 years ago, there would have been 4,000 couples. 4,050 years ago, 42,000 couples. 4,000 years ago, 400,000 couples. 3,950, 4 million couples. By the time Abraham arrived, there could have easily been 42 million people living in Egypt. That's how fast populations grow. There is absolutely no problem explaining large advanced civilizations really fast after the flood. It makes total sense, actually. The whole idea that people evolved 100,000 years ago and we don't find billions of dead graves and dead bodies is what doesn't make sense. This time frame is fantasy, that people have been around as long as we've been told. Now, let's look at Egypt. We're going to look at the oldest civilization on Earth, okay? All these other civilizations were probably just small groups of people trying to survive, but an actual civilization, everybody acknowledges Egypt is essentially the oldest. They were building pyramids right off the bat. Now, I have this suspicion the Tower of Babel was a pyramid structure because all these ancient civilizations were building pyramids. I think they took that idea out of Babel, and I think they were building it in case there was another flood when God promised he'd never send another flood. They were sinning. They were not trusting God, so he broke them into different groups. For that and other reasons. That pyramid is made of 5 billion pounds of limestone, and it's been accurately calculated there are about 2.3 million individual blocks. Most of them have been taken from a quarry 500 miles away. So they transported these blocks 500 miles. It was believed to have been completed in 20 years, and that's pretty uniform across all Egypt books. The Pharaoh that commissioned it was a young man, and he died 20 years later, and it was to be his tomb, and he was buried in it. So they think it took 20 years to build. Well, if you take, you can do the math, if you take 2.3 million blocks and you divide by 365 days a year and 24 hours a day and 60 minutes per hour, they would have had to put one of these blocks in place every 5 minutes. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, every 5 minutes, another block going into place. Think of the logistical engineering nightmare that would be, let alone they're perfectly sized. They covered this whole thing with what are called capstones that were made out of marble, so they were gleaming white, okay? But on the outside, they're a smooth surface. On the inside, they're a stair step cut. And each of them were exactly 12 foot long, plus or minus a 16th of an inch. I'm not sure we could do that today with that kind of accuracy. And they had to level the base perfectly level, because if there were little ups and downs, every time you set a block on that, you'd have a bump in the next layer, and the blocks are all uniform. So the base had to be perfectly level. It's level within 0.001 inch per foot of length. That in engineering, that's called 1 mil. We have computer-driven CNC milling machines in order to get a metal plate that flat. They did it over a 14-acre base. And I love this one. That pyramid's exactly one-third of the way from the equator to the North Pole. It's called the Prime Meridian. It's a really important astronomical location on the Earth. You have to know the diameter of the Earth precisely in order to place it where it's at. They knew the diameter of the Earth. And it was aligned within 2% of a single degree to true south. So they wanted to align the lines of that pyramid with the magnetic field of the Earth. They came within 2% of 1 degree. That's really, really, really precise. In 1859, we built the Greenwich Observatory. All the time zones of the world are set by where that observatory is at. And they wanted to align it perfectly north-south. With all of our modern technology, all of our compasses, all of our instrumentation in 1869, we got within 6% of a single degree. At the very beginning of human civilization, they were way more accurate than we were almost 4,000 years later. Stupid, ape-like, slowly evolving mankind, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. These guys had access to technology and knowledge from before the flood. On the other end of the spectrum, at the same time of Earth history, where, and I'll get to the Ice Age in a second, there's an Ice Age raging, people have always been prejudiced. Certain people groups are shoved to the outskirts of humanity, the least desirable areas. And Europe would have been that kind of area. There's ice sheets spreading down from Scandinavia through Germany into France, all the way down into Spain. The equator was never covered with ice. It's warm, but the upper regions were. And people called Neanderthal man were eking out an existence. And we found hundreds of their skulls. Now, they weren't stupid. It's now acknowledged these people were 100% human beings. They're just a variation of the human genetic code. And they took care of their elders. They were Neanderthals found with broken legs, and they had been set and regrown and taken care of, so they survived. They're elderly people buried with valuable artifacts, as if they knew something came after this life. They brought down great game animals like mastodons and saber-toothed tigers that were living during the Ice Age, and they had to have been hunting in coordinated groups to have done that sort of thing. So they were communicating. They are shown to have sewn leather with leather sewing tools. These weren't stupid people, and they were really, oh, I love that. In one of the pages in the book, is called Neanderthal Invents Super Glue, okay? Scientists found this big old stone flint spearhead, like glued to the end of a long pole. Now, the rawhide had rotted away. It had also been tied, but it was literally glued to the wood when the rawhide had all rotted away. It was still glued there. The glue had lasted for 4,000 years. And they started analyzing it. What is this? How did they figure out how to glue this stone spearhead to this pole? And they discovered it was the resin from a certain tree, like a birch tree, has a really water-resistant, sticky resin. But in order to get it to have this kind of adhesion, you've got to get it to cross-link. So you've got to heat it up to a certain temperature, like a very narrow temperature range. Like, it's in the book, but it's like 540 to 590 degrees Fahrenheit. If it's not that hot, it doesn't cross-link. If it goes hotter, it bursts into flames or it carbonizes. So you got to hold it in a real narrow temperature range. You got to keep it away from oxygen or it bursts into flames. And you got to hold it there for just the right amount of time. And if you don't do all of that, it doesn't become the super glue. So they figured out that's what Neanderthals were doing. And then they tried to reproduce it. They thought, well, the only thing we can think of is that they must have put this resin under a big rock and built a fire on top of the rock. And that would heat the resin and turn it into this really perfect glue. And then they used it. And they worked on it for months, and they couldn't get it to work. It would either get too hot or too cold or wouldn't stay hot long enough while they're building their fires. So they finally stuck, like, electronic thermocouples in the glue so they could modulate their fire and get it to work, and then they recreated some of it. Now think about what I'm just telling you. Modern man, with all of his technology, after months of effort, was finally able to reproduce what these guys were able to do without modern technology. So who's really the smarter one? They weren't dumb. They were smart, intelligent human beings. Incredibly artistic. Wherever you find these ape men, they've got time to draw these beautiful drawings on the wall absolutely accurately. So that's what's going on right after the flood. Now, for the next 1,000 years, humanity is rebuilding civilizations. And again, incredible abilities for what we see. There's advances in language, cultures, buildings, and it's near the end of that. Near the time of Moses, the Ice Age is coming to an end. Now, here's one of those stunning things that's been found. This should have been 2 slides, and I apologize, but underneath of the text, there's a map that was found in 1513, okay? There was a Turkish admiral that had this map, and it showed up. And it ended up in monasteries for a while, and then it finally got classified later in the 18 and 1900s. But they know that's when it was actually found. We don't know how far back it goes, but what this shows is the coastline of Antarctica when it's not covered by ice. Now, Antarctica is the landmass that's down the southern part of our globe, okay? And it's 100% covered by ice, and the ice near the coastline is about 1 mile thick, okay? It's covered with 1 mile of ice, and that ice extends out anywhere from 10 to 100 miles out past where the land ends, and that's Antarctica, okay? That land is under all this ice. We're told in textbooks that the ice age that covered Antarctica started 200,000 years ago, and it slowly tapered off and came to an end and came to a new equilibrium about 12,000 years ago. And it was in that 12 to 30,000 years ago period that woolly mammoths and saber-tooth cougars and all these animals lived. Well, that's not what happened. You see, the Ice Age is a result of warm water from all the land movement and all the volcanism during worldwide floods heating up the oceans of the entire globe to where there was way more evaporation. And that evaporation, as it happened, when it hit cooler air in the atmosphere, it would come down as either rain or snow. And in the south and north latitudes, it would come as snow. So while there's much more evaporation from the oceans, the forecast in Canada, the forecast down in South America and South Africa and Antarctica, every day is going to be snow. Snow today, snow tomorrow, snow next week, snow next month, snow next year, snow next decade. Decade after decade after decade, while the oceans are slowly cooling down because they're so massive, you have massive evaporation, it's going to come down as snow. Meanwhile, the equator is going to have way more rain. Remember when Moses showed up in Canaan and sent in the spies and they came back? They said it's the land flowing with milk and honey. It's green, it's lush, it's filled with trees, it's filled with grapevines. Today, that whole area is nothing but desert. 3,000, 4,000 years ago, there's way more rainfall. Until the Ice Age ended, and then the rain stopped, the snow slowed down, the ice melted back, and so on. Well, after the flood, people would have been exploring the world. The Phoenicians were master shipbuilders, and they owned the oceans. And they were right there along with Egypt and the Babylonians, early in Earth civilizations, exploring the world. they would have went down and explored Antarctica when it wasn't covered with snow, because the ocean's still warm. So the coastlines are still going to be warm. They drew it, probably mapped it. Those documents ended up in Egypt and other places. They probably were in the Library of Alexandria. They probably ended up in monasteries. And eventually, they ended up in this Turkish admiral's hands. So we have an explanation for how you could see the coastline of Antarctica. The coastline is like 10 miles back that way under 5,000 feet of snow. This map was sent to the Cartography Division of the United States Air Force in the 1960s. This is all documented in the brilliant book. And he looked at that because we did radar mapping of what's under that ice in the 1960s. And he acknowledged that what that map shows is an accurate reconstruction of what that coastline looks like. But it's supposedly been under snow for 200,000 years. See, it's all wrong. They can't be right. Biblically, the pieces of the puzzle all fall together and there's a reasonable explanation. The world's clueless. It's just a mystery they can't solve because they've left out the truth. See, the flood would have caused massive volcanism, massive continental land movement, not the slow continental drift, but rapid movement of the continental layers, mass extinctions, widespread rock deposition. But warmer oceans mean for 500 or 1,000 years, there'd be way more snow, way more evaporation. But the areas near the ocean would have never been covered by snow. And that's what we see, which is really interesting. The North Pole is right here, okay? So as a result, this area did get enough snow that the snow went all the way out to the edges. But further away from the North Pole, you'll notice the land was never covered by snow during the Ice Age. All around Alaska, never covered by snow during the Ice Age. Over here in Korea area, never covered by snow during the Ice Age. Because all of this never froze over. The ocean was never covered by snow during the Ice Age. The Arctic Ocean freezes over today. But the ocean was much warmer. So it kept those areas from freezing over. See, there's all sorts of data that supports a biblical viewpoint. Massive building projects were going on. These huge lower blocks down here, this is a million-pound block of stone specifically cut into tight little puzzle shapes. See, this rock has been cut and carved and cut into that shape, and this is like angles down into that shape, and they've all been cut to fit into this massive wall. And then here's other puzzle shapes up here. The later ones were built by the Incas, these smaller stones. These earlier ones were built by an advanced civilization that way predate the Incas and the Aztecs. Those were the earlier civilizations. Massive building projects. We don't even know how they did it and how they moved them. There are Indian burial mounds. These all came out of Michigan. They looked in burial mounds in Michigan that experts think will go back at least 3,000 years. So there were North Americans from Europe that came across the Bering Strait, spread across North America into South America and Central America, all the way into Michigan, Indiana, Pennsylvania. And they would build these mounds, and then they would bury things in them. And there was a book documented in 1910 by Rudolf Eisenhauser, where he looked at 30 copper and slate engravings that were found inside of these burial mounds. These are like grave robbers that were trying to find treasures. This was an Indian burial mound. And by the way, many of them are shaped like snakes. This is from central Ohio. You notice a big snake-like shape. Here's another snake in southern Ohio. Here's a pyramid-shaped mound in Marietta, Ohio, and so on. But look what they found inside of this mound. They found a Egyptian hieroglyph-like drawings of a big boat kind of thing with a bunch of animals coming off. Before that, there was a boat floating with a bird with something in its beak, a bunch of people drowning, and symbols at the top. Now, that could be a fake. You can't prove when someone shows up with something that they found it in a mound. Maybe, but it might not be. At least as a Christian, we can acknowledge there should have been knowledge of stuff like this. And the guy that wrote the book, he testifies that it was a real artifact. In Peru, they were doing brain surgery 3,200 years ago. Brain surgery. And nobody refutes it. Here are skulls, and I've been to Peru, and these are gold plates that have been placed inside of skulls of individuals. And they found hundreds of these. It wasn't even a rare occurrence. in the tombs. It's so dry in certain areas, nothing rots out. But that's a gold plate, and the bone has grown around it. You can see the regrowth of bone around it as they've done brain surgery 3,000 years ago. Couple more. This is in the National... Ah, bummer. I didn't want to show that yet. Okay, we'll see if anybody is a fast reader. They found this artifact. It's this round clay hardened fire disc, and it's in the National Museum in Athens, Greece, as a national treasure. Okay, they built a whole room around this thing. And it's because of what it shows that just astounds people. Now, in the year 2000, Time magazine every year has the Man of the Year, and it's become very liberal and political who they pick. But in the year 2000, they decided, we're going to pull all the experts and decide who is the most significant human being in the last 1,000 years, the man of the millennium, the man who has advanced the human condition and human knowledge and human welfare more than any other human being in the last 1,000 years, from the year 1000 after Christ until the year 2000. Who do you think they chose? Any guesses? Another one of those, just think about it for a second. In the last 1,000 years, who's the most significant human being? No guesses at all? Thomas Edison? I would put him right up there near the top. That's a good guess. That wasn't the one they picked. Darwin came up a lot, Charles Darwin, which is interesting because all he did was line up animals and say, see, this proves that bacteria turned into a human being. But it did change a lot that we're living in the world we live in because everybody bought into that. But that's not who they chose. Albert Einstein's a good one. Totally turned physics on its head. What was thought to be the laws of science turned out to be there, but other explanations. I'll tell you, it was Johann Gutenberg. Why? Because up until Gutenberg, there was no reason for anybody to learn to read unless you were rich, because books were really expensive, hand-copied, hand-bound, no fast way to reproduce them. Just interesting bit of trivia, what was the first book ever printed by Gutenberg? The Bible. And an original Gutenberg Bible is worth about $100 million right now. There's like a few dozen left, if that. But what that did, it made it so everybody could read God's word, not just the upper echelon. You could reproduce information from one generation to the next without losing the information. Language became common, knowledge became transferable. It's what drove the scientific revolution that changed the whole world that we live in. It's what drove the reformation of Christianity, because now it just wasn't the monks and the Catholic priests that had access to God's word. Everybody could read for themselves. And people didn't no longer put up with the lies that was being said about God's word. Changed the whole world in that 1,000-year period. Transformed all of humanity. And what did he do? He just put a permanent hardened type in a tray, covered it with ink, and then made multiple copies of that same information on pieces of paper, the printing press. That concept. That was 15-something, okay? Except the Greeks were doing it 2,500 years earlier. Gutenberg didn't discover it. The knowledge was just lost. They took little hardened-type symbols and placed them into a circular tray and then would take soft clay and transfer the impression of that information and make multiple copies of the same information in that way. And all you had to do was change ink on paper instead of impressions on clay. But it's the same concept. But Greece was a bunch of little warring kingdom cities, and one city would wipe out another, and whoever developed the technology, they were conquered, and then technology was lost for 2,500 years. But it was already invented. These people weren't stupid. In Costa Rica, they loved to make like Texas-sized marbles. They've got these perfect spheres that are so common. They've been dug up and used as lawn ornaments, up to 6 feet in diameter. And we're told Costa Rica, you go to Google and you say, when did Costa Rica's, when was it first inhabited? And they'll say it was somewhere in the 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 year ago range. But people back then had no technology to do this. They had nothing but dugout canoes. And we've found these spheres 330 miles offshore, and they weigh up to 30,000 pounds. How are you going to take a 30,000-pound rock 300 miles offshore in a dugout canoe? It was transported out there from the land. So there's a past technology from really, really smart people that is just being denied. The next 1,000 years is just rapid growth. You have the Persians and then the Greeks and then the Romans, and we're just moving across the world. These amphitheaters of the Greeks are phenomenal in their acoustics. The University of Austin spent a graduate program was to study how come they have such good acoustics. And everybody thought it was just the shape, but it's not just the shape. It's the spacing of the rows of the material, and it's the exact angles, and it's even the materials themselves are used in such a way that they will dampen like rustling noise and breathing, and they will accentuate human speech. It's incredible engineering. And you find these amphitheaters all over the Roman world. In Iraq, they found batteries, literal electric batteries. But they're in clay jars with an iron cathode and an electrolyte inside, and a cathode and an anode, and they put out 1 to 2 volts. And we don't know what they did with them. But it's not just one, they found dozens of them. Mythbusters had a program where they talked about this, and it turns out you could link these up and you could do electroplating. And some of that ancient jewelry has such a thin, molecular thin layer of metals, they've never been able to figure out how they've done that. So there's a lot of speculation they used these for electroplating back in this early culture. And the last one I'm going to talk about is this ancient gear-like structure that was found in the Mediterranean. It was found in 1901, and it was just this coral-encrusted, chunk of stuff, bronze. So it got thrown on a shelf because they were looking for coins and vases and valuable stuff they can put in museums. Well, in 1971, I believe, they started a project up in Canada where they got access to this, and they started doing X-ray analysis and so on. And they determined there were 82 different fragments. And inside of this coral structure, there are 32 very specifically designed bronze gears. And they're thinking, well, what is this? It's obviously not a clock. What is this? And I think they studied it for almost 20 years and came out with a report in the early 2000s. And this is what they think the back plate looked like when they got it more cleaned up. It's just got a series of rings with lots of different information and some pointers. 2006 is when the report came out. Here's the guy who headed the program at Cardiff University in Canada. Here's his quote. "This device is extraordinary, one of a kind. The design is beautiful. The astronomy is exactly right. The mechanisms make your draw drop. Whoever did it was extremely careful in terms of scarcity and historical value. It's more valuable than the Mona Lisa." So what is it? Well, the clue is there. It has to do with astronomy. Here's what they think it looked like. They kind of did a reconstruction. On one side, there's this set of dials where you can turn a crank, and the gears will turn, and you can set a dial to any date, like a month ago, a year ago, 10 years ago, in the past or the future, 20 years, 100 years into the future. You set your dials on that date, and the dial on the back with a series of concentric rings will tell you the position in the sky where you can find Mercury, Mars, Venus, Saturn, and Jupiter. Anytime in the past or the present. It's a computational gear-driven computer. Now, how many here think they could build that? This was built over 2,000 years ago. Cast bronze gears put together. It's phenomenal, the intelligence of these people. And if they could do it 2,000 years ago, it wouldn't surprise me if they did it much, much earlier than that. This is just the only one left. You know, we're told biblically we were casting iron and bronze within the fourth generation of after Adam was made. So there is no bronze age and iron age and stone age. There's just different levels of lost or retained information built upon previous information. And if you start out with none, you're in the stone age. If you start out with lots of it, you're in a very intelligent age. And the book also goes into radiocarbon dating and exactly what the assumptions are and how come those ages are so off as you get closer and closer to the flood. Because it assumes you everything always started with the same amount of radiocarbon we have in our bodies today. Well, that's not the case. While the magnetic field of the Earth was stronger, there would have been way less radiocarbon being produced, and there was a big step change during the flood. So the closer you get to the flood, the farther off those dates get. And it's really logical scientific analysis instead of assuming. But now I'm going to come back to the beginning. Take any of our kids and you send them into a university and they're sitting in a world history or science or biology or anthropology or any class in college and they say, well, I believe Adam and Eve didn't exist until 6,000 years ago and they were suddenly created. They're going to be considered ignorant, stupid, absurd, ridiculous people. It's just assumed that isn't true. And unless they have the evidence, they're just going to get swayed. And that's what's happening to our kids as we send them off like sheep to a slaughter into universities that are just totally clueless of what the truth is. But if they understand that the teachers and the textbooks, they're simply operating on a different set of assumptions, therefore, they're coming to the wrong answer, they're going to understand why these things are being told to them. So this is really, really important. And last, what happens when you leave a creator out? Four times God told us in the very first chapter of the Bible, he made us in his image. That means it's really important. And I just, in the book, I kind of speculate, what are the four ways we were made in God's image? One is that we have a moral foundation. Two is that we're intelligent and inventive. Three, we're artistic. Four, we have compassion and empathy. Those are God's characteristics. And all those are lost when we leave a creator out of our thinking. Everything becomes relative. Morality degenerates. Life is cheapened. Societies fall apart. And that's the history of every civilization and humanity, because they either make God in our image or they leave God out and they're worshiping the wrong thing. So I talk about that in the last page of the book. I hope this is kind of helpful. And I see a lot of creation lectures that just kind of talk about a lot of facts, and I try to put it into a perspective of things you haven't necessarily heard and that are useful for trusting God's word. How am I doing on time? It's a little before 2. We have time for Q&A. So this is my favorite part of all my sessions. Stuff I went too fast, stuff you don't understand, stuff you don't understand how it fits, please ask.
Yeah, so put your hand up. I'll run the mic to you. Anybody? All right, a lot of great information. Job well done. Okay, we have one? Okay. And just share your name and your question.
Yeah, hi, I'm Tim Sexton.
Hey, Tim.
And while this might not pertain directly towards your messaging today, I do have a question as to why demons fight so hard when you're actually trying to come back towards God and making things a lot harder to actually come back towards God.
Yeah. Well, Satan's goal, and he's in charge of his legion of demons, is to kill, murder, lie, and destroy. And as long as you're floating around, entertaining yourself, and living in one area or another of immorality, you're not as effective as a Christian. You're not as effective for changing other people's lives and drawing them toward the truth. So why spend their time concentrating on you if that's the case? But as soon as we start to do the repent, turn, and go in the opposite direction, we're moving to where we're going to be more effective in making an impact for God and changing other people's lives. So of course they're going to fight. Of course they're going to deceive. Of course they're going to make things harder. I'm now serving God. Why am I having these problems instead of being blessed? Well, God's going to strengthen you through it. And this I don't understand. I don't understand the degree and latitude toward which God gives satanic things and deceptions sway on people. It seems like some people he just goes out of his way to bring them back, and other people, it seems like God doesn't draw them as hard. That I can't answer. But I suspect It's because God's outside of time. He knows no matter what he does, it's not going to work anyway. So even God holds back and equips and shields those who are seeking and serving and moving toward him. There's whole cultures that seem to be totally blinded. Why isn't God just changing all that? It all falls into that understanding of our free will. And God will never violate our free will. Otherwise, we're just robots, and there's no love. There's no love unless there's freedom. So I kind of rambled a little bit, but I hope that helps. The more effective you're becoming, the more likely that you are that Satan's going to come after you.
Yeah, and there's an assumption behind a great question. That is, there's a spiritual world. This material world that we see is not the only thing that there is. There is a spiritual world, and that's a great assumption to make there. Yeah. Thank you, Bruce, for a great answer. Yeah. Anybody else from question for Bruce? Yep. Okay. Your name and your question.
My name is Jill.
Hi, Jill.
Hello. My question is, I wrote down each new copy of DNA has more errors.
It does. Mutation. Scientific, absolute, established fact.
So what is your thoughts or what do we know from Adam and Eve to where we are now? How much of the original DNA information do you think has been lost?
Not a lot. When God does something, he does it well. He built into the DNA of every cell all sorts of error-correcting mechanisms, all sorts of protection mechanisms, all sorts of eliminating of bad information mechanisms. But in spite of all that, because of the fallen world, some of them get through. On average, there are somewhere between 100 and 1,000 permanent genetic changes, random changes to the book. If you think of our genetic code as a book, and that book is like 10,000 pages long, only like 1,000 words are going to be misspelled in 10,000 pages. But it's even more than 10,000 pages. We have 3 billion letters in our DNA code. Now, only about 10% of those letters are used for information that actually makes the proteins, that makes the cells, that makes the parts and the pieces of our body. The rest of it is redundant information, it's backup information, it's error checking information, it's structural stuff. It was repeated for almost 40 years since the discovery of DNA, from the late 1950s all the way up into the 2010s. Just repeated over and over and over and over again that most of our DNA is junk DNA. It's just leftover information from when we used to be an ape, and they had leftover information from when they used to be some sort of raccoon creature, and that was leftover information from when they used to be a fish, and it's just all that DNA is just junk. Well, that stopped the advance of science because they weren't looking for purposes and functions for anything that wasn't making proteins, making the parts of our body. And only about 10% of DNA does that. Well, we've now found out it all has a useful function. Now, some of it, because of genetic mistakes and spelling errors, now does not function as well as it used to. But how much of it has deteriorated? Probably way less than 1% of the 3 billion letters. But you take a computer program and you randomly rearrange 1%, How well do you think that computer program is going to work? It's going to have all sorts of issues. It probably isn't going to work at all. The computer is going to crash if you randomly change 1% of the information. What I think is kind of miraculous is that within the range of 1% information, that we're still able to make perfectly good bodies. Now here's, I'm going to go a little further on that question. That was a really good question. I think at some point, you make a mistake, and then you had another mistake, and you had another mistake. It's not a slow deterioration. At some point, it's like a sharp drop-off, and that's probably what happened with lifetimes. Reached a point where something critical changed, and lifetimes dropped off dramatically. The geneticists can now go back, and they can see when in history, when in the human family did a certain mistake appear. And they've pretty definitively shown that given how fast mistakes are happening, there's only been 200 or so generations of human beings right back to the original human being. And then you can go back to the original set of information, which is exactly what you would expect biblically, that few of generations. And furthermore, the reason brothers and sisters can't get married and cousins can't get married is because if the random mistakes on my genes happen to match the random mistakes on my wife's genes and we have a baby, that child is almost guaranteed to have that allergy or that genetic mistake or that malformity or that psychological problem. All of these trace to genetic mistakes. There's about 5,000 mistakes on every one of our bodies. That'd be 100 times 5 times, 5,000 years. Actually, it'd be more than that, 50,000. But they've identified 5,000 mistakes that they know cause human problems. Are you following me so far? Now, if you have that mistake, one of those 5,000, and your wife also has that mistake, your child's almost guaranteed to manifest the problem. Now, if only you have it and your wife doesn't have it, your child probably won't manifest that problem. That's the reason close relations can't get married, because there's so many mistakes on our genes. If you go back in history, Abraham was married to his half-sister. The Egyptians routinely married brothers and sisters. Royalty in other cultures routinely married brothers and sisters. And there's no record of genetic issues or genetic problems. So in only 3,000 to 4,000 years, the human genetic code has deteriorated to the point. At the time of Moses is when God said brothers, sisters, and cousins are never to get married. But before that, it was no problem. So that's one of those indications people have not been around that long. The genetic mistakes are building up really, really fast, relatively fast, over thousands of years. Now, how long will we last? Probably one of the world's top geneticists, his name's John Sanford. And if you get my Rocks Crowd episodes, two of my episodes end, I spent a weekend with him. He's a good friend. He worked at Cornell University, was an atheist his whole life, until he realized every genetic code of every creature in the world is slowly deteriorating. None of them are getting better. None of them are turning into more advanced animals with more capabilities. Everything is deteriorating. And he looked around and he realized Christianity and the Bible is the only thing out there that can explain this. It all has to be true. And he's shown that we can't be tens of thousands of years old. Humanity was recently created and everything's deteriorating downward. Now, modern medical science has allowed us to preserve and slow down and extend people's lives by dealing with all these issues. But without all our modern vaccinations and all of our modern medicine and all our modern antibiotics and such, the average life of people has now dropped in cultures that don't have all that into the 40 to 50 year range. So we started out at 900. By the time of Abraham, it was down to 200. By the time of Moses, it was down to 80. Right now, without all sorts of modern technology, it would be down in the 40 range. So things are continuing to deteriorate. That was a long answer. I hope you don't mind.
No, I don't mind. Here's another question. I've had this said to me a lot, and I never have a good succinct response. Well, we share 95% of our genetic material with monkeys. Yeah. So how could we not have come from them? There's a quick way to respond.
Yeah, I'll give you two quick responses. A good architect, when he's building a bridge and then called to build another bridge, he isn't going to throw out all of his methods and all his understanding and build a completely new structure. He's going to use what works well between different things. And that's what God did. He uses structures that work really well to build animals of different things. An example in every textbook, they'll show a penguin with an upper arm, lower arm, and fingers. They'll show a bat with an upper arm, lower arm, and fingers. They'll show a horse that has an upper leg, lower leg, and a hoof that used to be different digits. Then they'll show a person and they'll say, see, this proves they all had the common ancestor. It doesn't prove anything. It proves they had a designer that used an elegant design in many different, very useful ways. Second, the And by the way, you are very generous. For decades, students were told that apes and chimpanzees were 98 or 99% identical, their DNA. This started back in the 70s when they had never even decoded the DNA of a monkey versus an ape. Because they had just looked at the molecular structure of certain molecules, cytochrome C and certain proteins. And between the monkeys and the apes, they were 98, 90% similar. And they found other things, and they said, see, that proves the DNA is that similar. And it just kept getting repeated over and over and over again. It wasn't until 2010, after a 10-year project, spending hundreds of millions of dollars, they had decoded letter by letter exactly what the DNA sequence of a human being was. And then a few years later, they decoded the DNA sequence finished of a chimpanzee, and they compared the two. And if you just line them up, molecule by molecule, section by section, there is somewhere between a 10 and 20% difference. It's not 98 or 99 or 95. Our DNA is 3 billion letters long. That means there's 600 million letters that are different between a chimpanzee and us. 600 million. You can't even explain 100 of them by evolutionary changes, because all of the information in the ape has to disappear while all new information in the human has to reappear. And to do that just by interbreeding, you can do the mathematical calculations, and you can't get it to disappear and reappear that fast. Not over tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. Most of it would still be there. But it's not. It's totally different information. So what genetics actually shows is there's so much difference in the genetic code, one could have never come from the other. They were independently created. And here's another thing that you can tell people, a third thing, and that is I just lost the thought. The other 80% is the same because we live in the same environment. We all have to breathe air. We all have to have hair to protect our bodies. We all have the same body structure. We all have to metabolize the same food. We have the same organs. So obviously there's gonna be a great similarity. I wish I had time. If I had my computer, I'd do this. Can you pull up the Rocks Crying Out teaser of episode number 6? The last episode on the Rocks Crying Out is about Ape Man, the similarity between apes and humans and what all these ape creatures are and all these little monkeys with sloped foreheads and bigger brains that are using tools. They found these kind of bones, okay, so I deal with that. John Sanford in that last episode, he said, and he's just this elegant, soft-spoken, he doesn't preach and get all excited like me because he's an academic person, but he's just got this sincerity and authority that you can't invent or fabricate. And he just looks into the camera and he said, and you can watch this, it's in episode number 18. He said, you know, I had an atheist that came up to me, a student, and he was just being sarcastic, and he said, so did God just make apes to look like us to deceive us? And he said, I've thought about that. I've thought about that for years. God could have not made apes and monkeys, and they're not going to believe we came from a horse or a dog. Why would he make apes or monkeys? And he said, there's another kind of faith that God has, and that's a inconclusive faith. I mean, he could just show up someday and stand right in front of us, and you would know that Jesus Christ is God, and he's going to do that someday. But in the meantime, he wants us to believe because we don't have to believe. And he just, I think, makes some things indefinite to test our faith, and so we'll decide whether we want to believe a lie or believe the truth. And the world is always going to have reasons. They're always going to have excuses. They're always going to have evidence. And it's ultimately going to come down to, are you going to trust me and are you going to trust my word, or are you going to trust what the world is saying? And that's the story of all human history. You're going to trust Satan, you're going to trust my word. And so maybe that's why apes exist. And they are a little bit similar, But there's a vast difference. They're nowhere near as similar as we're being told. Do I have three more minutes or not?
Two.
Oh, this one doesn't even take two. I want you to see the quality of these videos because they're an incredible tool. So we'll end with this little teaser for the lesson on the age of creation.
To pretend that God has always had death and disease and bloodshed and extinctions in this creation is a very distortion of what God's Word says. I often hear people say, well, it really doesn't matter when God created as long as I acknowledge that God is creator. God tells us that creation is not just good, but very good. There is method after method after method after method of determining how old are things, and time after time, they show a recent creation. The central emphasis of everything is life began on Earth 4.5 billion years ago. That is the foundation of the whole philosophy of evolution and naturalism. We've got to go around an established system of training people to think in only one possible way. Millions and billions of years, evolution is a fact, and show them the beauty and reality of the evidence that supports a true biblical creation model of why we exist.
Okay, that's good. I just want you to see, this isn't just me standing and preaching. These are fun, engaging, interesting videos, and I hope you'll put them to use. Okay.
Bruce Malone, everybody.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right.
Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And I love how your mind works. God has gifted you that way. Let me pray for the group, and we'll let you go. Father, thank you so much for this day, and thank you for Bruce and his ministry to us. Thank you all so much for the truth of what's been shared. And now I ask and pray that we will live in light of this reality, the true reality, and the true history of the world. And to think today we have access to the true record of human history, and it's called a Bible. And we've got a bunch of them, digitally and hard copy. And as we engage in your word, may we see you looking back at us, engaging and inviting and wooing us to yourself, and that we will walk with you, our Creator guide, that this would be the case for all those here today. In your name, amen.